Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Egan Marine v. Great American Insurance. Mr. O'Malley.
Good morning. My name is John O'Malley. I represent the appellants and the plaintiffs in the underlying case, Egan Marine Corporation, Service Welding and Shipbuilding, LLC. My client, Dennis Egan, is with us today. Your Honor, this is an appeal following a bench trial, and jurisdiction is obviously properly before the court. The basis of jurisdiction below was admiralty jurisdiction. What this case primarily involves on appeal is an issue and several issues of candor to the court and issues of candor that an insurance company owes to its insured. That's very important in this case. We have an insured, Egan Marine Corporation, who suffered a devastating explosion down on the Sanitary and Ship Canal involving the Lisa E, which is a tugboat, and the barge EMC 423, which is a tank barge which was hauling slurry oil. There was an explosion, and Egan Marine and its sister company, Service Welding and Shipbuilding, undertook to raise the sunken EMC 423 from the bottom of the canal and brought it to the surface using heretofore unknown technologies that were created by my client. What we have here, though, involves Egan Marine's insurance company, who fell down on the job. And one of the most important duties that an insurance company owes to its insured is a duty to timely reserve its rights and to advise its insured of its coverage under its insurance policy. And that was very important from day one here because of the nature of the disaster. What was going to happen is the expense associated with bringing the barge up from the bottom of the canal was going to cost significantly in excess of the $5 million policy limits that Egan later learned. Great American was taking the position was the only limit that applied. There's a secondary issue here of candor to the court. We have established in our briefs that the underlying judgment was based upon a determination by the district court following a district court opinion from New York from 2000 that we have established in our briefs, and I think I established below, is not good law under New York law. In fact, the highest court of appeals in New York in 2008 had issued two very important companion pieces of companion opinions. The one opinion would be Panagia, and the other would be Bioeconomy Mechanical, and I know I've discussed those at length in the brief. Those decisions created a sea change in New York law that was very, very significant and undercut the sole case upon which the district court relied. And the reason that the district court relied on that opinion was because that was the sole opinion upon which Great American relied in its pretrial order, which satisfied the requirements leading into trial of setting forth the party's various coverage positions. It's very important to reiterate that that opinion, Panagia and Bioeconomy Mechanical, were addressed in Egan's portion of the pretrial order specifically. And then they were mentioned in closing as well. And I'll be perfectly honest, when Judge Cannelli first asked me that, whether I'd mentioned those cases in the closing argument, I didn't remember doing that, but looking at the transcript, it is clear that I mentioned those cases. What's also clear is that Great American did not mention those cases. And that's very important to our first argument, and probably the argument will take up most of my time today, which involves the judgment against Egan Marine on count two of the complaint for the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing.
Mr. Miley, said that's the highest appellate court in New York?
Yes, New York Court of Appeals.
Isn't that the appellate division of the Supreme Court?
Yeah, I believe it's called the New York Court of Appeals.
Yeah, is that you're talking about Panagia Estates?
Panagia Estates and Bioeconomy Markets. And actually, I do go ahead in my report.
The appellate division? I don't want to argue with you about the highest court. The highest court is the Court of Appeals in New York.
That's correct.
Yeah, this is the appellate division of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is the trial court in New York.
That is correct. And that's the highest level court is New York Court of Appeals. There's an appellate division, and then there's
appellate division of the Supreme Court. That's the intermediate court, right?
I believe that's correct.
And the Court of Appeals is the highest court.
That is correct. And we have an opinion from New York, two opinions, companion cases in Bioeconomy Markets and in Panacea, which were issued by the highest court of the state of New York. In addition, we have an intermediate appellate court decision, which is upon remand, which is Panacea States versus Hudson, 889 New York sub second, 452. And in that case, if I could highlight for the court, the proper standard under New York law in considering a decision for the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing is as follows. And the court says, plaintiff is correct in arguing that the motion court erred by stating that consequential damages do not lie for breach of insurance contract absent bad faith. That is New York law, and that is not the standard, the legal standard that the district court applied. And I submit that the reason that the court did not apply that is because Great American had represented to the district court that New York did not follow and did not permit an action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And it is clear after Bioeconomy Market and Panacea that that is simply not the case. And therefore,
I think it's a little more nuanced than that, counsel. As I understand, the district court's ruling based on New York law is not that there isn't any such thing as a claim for bad faith in the insurance context, but that it has to be premised on some other conduct than the actual breach of contract itself. And then the argument that you're making about consequential damages just goes to the measure of damages. If a claim is made and factually substantiated on conduct separate and apart from the breach of contract, that's how I understand the distinction here.
That's certainly what the district court did. The district court found that there was no cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, absent that it couldn't form the same basis of the breach of contract. The court relied upon Kerry Oil Company, which is a 2000 district court opinion. And then in 2008, as I suggested, there was a sea change in New York law, and Panacea and Bioeconomy Market changed the legal standard for what constituted a cause of action for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Therefore, the court's opinion below specifically says, under New York law, there is no independent claim for breach of good faith and fair dealing if it is based simply on the conduct that forms the basis of the breach of contract claim. That was the law as it existed prior to 2008, prior to Panacea, prior to Bioeconomy Market. That is no longer the law. The law now, and the correct standard under New York law, is whether the determinative issue is whether such damages were within the contemplation of the parties as the probable result of a breach at the time of or prior to contracting.
That goes to measure of damages, not the foundation of the claim.
I think it does. And what it does is it permits an award of extra contractual damages upon the showing of the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing. And that can now be based upon the same conduct that constitutes a breach of duty. And I think the Panacea standard, and I think that's illuminated by the dissenting opinion in both Bioeconomy and Panacea, where the district court, Judge Smith, stated that the majority had abandoned a pre-existing rule and had adopted a new legal standard. And that new legal standard was set forth in Panacea, and it was set forth in Bioeconomy Markets. And those are very, very significant cases. And I believe it was incumbent on the insurance company to alert Judge Cannelli to that standard, and I believe by his application to Kerry Oil, which, again, was not an insurance case. Kerry Oil was not an insurance case. That case was a 2000, long predated Panacea, long predated the Panacea States in the interim court in New York.
Did you alert the district court to this what you're characterizing as a sea change?
Absolutely. I did that in the pretrial order, which is attached as it's in the record below. It's at a document 2005. And in addition, as I mentioned earlier, t- To my surprise, I did not remember arguing law during the closing argument following the trial. I was a little surprised that I did it, but I did. I mentioned Panagia. I mentioned bioeconomy during the closing arguments. I did not give the citations, but I certainly argued it, and I believe, as I sit here today, I did specifically use the word sea change in connection with that closing argument. So it's very important, and I think it's important to understand that, that I don't believe that the district court, and I think it's clear from the judge's ruling, that the judge did not apply the correct legal standard. And the legal standard, again, as I said, was set forth in bioeconomy. And because of Great American's conduct, because Great American wasn't forthright with the court, Egan was denied a fair trial in connection with its claim for the duty of the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. And there's a secondary level here that I think really, when I got a hold of the response brief filed by Great American, I think it was pretty clear that my argument had more than merit. When we saw the Great American before this court took the position that admiralty law applied. And that is not a position that they had taken before. That was, again, a sea change, if I can borrow my own phrase, again, from the position they took in the district court. And I was quite surprised by that. I have, again, earlier cited to the final pretrial order. It's, again, in the record of 2005, attached as, I'm sorry, it's 2002. I had attached a copy of the pretrial order. It is before the court. And Great American in there, and if I can take a minute, in GAIC's proposed conclusions of law, the court has held that New York law governs plaintiff's claim under the policy. That's paragraph 147. And in paragraph 160, they cite Carry Oil from 2000 and a New York University case, that NYU case, that I mentioned, made reference to earlier in the dissenting opinion on page 44 at paragraph 160. So in other words, Great American below adamantly took the position that New York law applied. And when they come before this court, they took the position that only admiralty law applied, which again was a completely different position than they've taken before. And as a result, I think it's fairly clear that they have forfeited the issue.
Mr. O'Malley, your opponents cite Goldmark versus Caitlin Syndicate.
Yes.
And I don't see that in your reply brief. I know it wasn't in your opening brief. Do you want to comment on that case?
I do, Judge. Can you give me a minute? I have it on a note here. Goldmark is a case. It is a 2011 United States District Court case. I could not find a published version of it. What that case involved was a motion to dismiss, and the holding of the court in that case was that leave to amend was granted to follow the Panagia and Bioeconomy Mutual standard. In other words, that case does not support Great American's position here. It follows Panagia, and it is a motion to dismiss. It is a pleading case, and in that case, the insured was permitted to go ahead and to prosecute that claim for the breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing. That is a motion to dismiss case, and I think had the district court followed the line of cases in Panagia and Bioeconomy, I think they would have come to the same conclusion as Goldmark did. And I think there's a string cite, and I thank you for your indulgence of letting me dig it out. I couldn't remember, so I have my notes on every one of those cases. And I thought what the most important case, maybe, was a case at the end of that string cite on page 16 of Great American's brief, Cardin versus Allstate. And my note here says, summary judgment on claim entered in favor of the insured, in favor of the policyholder. And again, those are cases that apply Panagia and apply bioeconomy. And those are cases that, unfortunately, because of the fact that those issues, that the cases were not referenced by Great American, and only Carry Oil was, Those are the cases upon which the court did not rely on Panagia. And I think...
What's the factual basis for your bad faith claim?
There is several factual basis. I've already mentioned the first being that there wasn't a reservation of rights issued right off the bat. And there was an admission during the deposition, and there was an admission during the trial testimony of Great American's own adjuster, who handled this case from soup to nuts, that it was a question of fairness for the insured. It was a question of fairness for the insurer to issue a timely reservation of rights. That's first. The second issue is Great American pulled up and left the site, left the barge, which is still sitting in the sanitary and ship canal. Still, you can actually see it. If you look at satellite photographs, you can see this damaged barge. It's sitting in the city of Chicago. It's sitting in Lamont on the sanitary and ship canal. And Great American pulled off, and they pulled off on the basis that their policy was exhausted. And I spent a lot of time. I had a calculator with me as I was preparing for trial. And I took a look at the affidavits that had been submitted by Great American to the National Pollution Fund. And I subtracted the amount they claimed they paid from the amount that they claim they paid that was not part of the policy limits. If you subtract those two, there's still about $280,000 left in that policy limit. And that is a question, and I know that the district court ruled against me on that issue based upon a comment in a letter from Great American's counsel. But the bottom line is, at the time they took the position that the policy was exhausted, not only had they not paid that money, they hadn't paid the money. Even when they claimed it was exhausted, there's still $280,000 on it.
Does that make any difference in the bottom line once the Lisa E. policy limits are in play?
It did, and I'll tell you why, because the third issue I wanted to talk about was the defense of the state of Illinois versus Egan Marine. As we saw in the record and as I established in my briefs, Great American initially took the position that that claim was a covered claim, retained lawyers to defend it, and did so without a reservation of rights. Then Great American, based upon its erroneous claim that they had exhausted the policy limit for the barge EMC 423, pulled out of the defense, stopped paying the lawyers that were defending that claim, and as a result, Egan was forced to go ahead and defend that claim on its own. And I know that we talk a lot here in Chicago, Illinois, about Illinois law and the breach of the duty to defend and estoppel. But it's more than that. It left the insured high and dry. Absolutely left them without a defense in that lawsuit. And as a result, Egan was forced to go out and hire its own lawyer, which it had to take in-house, and defend that case.
Right, but you prevailed on that part of the claim, didn't you?
Absolutely, but we spent a significant amount of money doing so, and Great American wasn't there for it. So we have an issue where, based upon the breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, based upon those misrepresentations, they pulled off the site, they stopped paying the claim, they stopped defending the lawsuits, they left Egan on its own. And to date, even after the judge found that the policy limit for the Lisa E. applies, which it does, and there still hasn't been any money flowing from Great American to Egan Marine, either to defend to reimburse for past defense costs, or more importantly, the barge is still sitting there. It is still filled with slurry oil in its wing tanks and in other locations. And a wing tank is a part of the barge where there absolutely should not be fuel oil.
But so, the relevant regulatory authorities have signed off on that, haven't they?
They have not. The state of Illinois has had
sued. That there's no risk of future contamination?
I don't believe the state of Illinois has ever taken that position.
Does the Illinois lawsuit not take that position?
I'm sorry, I interrupted. The Illinois lawsuit is over. But there's two important factors. First of all, that boat is still subject to the jurisdiction of the United States Coast Guard. It is inspected and it is maintained pursuant to an agreement between Egan Marine Corp and the Coast Guard. Otherwise, it could not be sitting in the water. And basically, the accommodation that was come to that Dennis Egan testified to during the trial was that because Egan did not have the wherewithal to go ahead and clean up that barge, pending the outcome of this case, it still needs to be cleaned up. It still is contaminated. But that's another very good point. And the other good point that I wanted to make is, under the policy language, even absent a directive, there's still coverage. And what's very important here is this policy applies to remedial expenses incurred under federal and state law to remediate, to avoid liability, and that's voluntary. There doesn't have to be a directive under this insurance policy language. And that is a very, very significant factor here. There doesn't have to be a directive. Egan can voluntarily act in order to prevent environmental pollution, and that is what it's done. And I think to reinforce that point, one of the absolute key admissions during the trial below was Captain Newman's testimony and Captain Newman's submission to the fund as part of Great American.
I don't want to shoot you down in mid-flight, but you're into your rebuttal.
I'm sorry?
See, you're into your rebuttal, but you go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I've been looking at that light. I didn't see it go on. I'll finish my point. Captain Newman wrote, as part of the joint submission of the claim to the fund, that Egan Marine Corporation had incurred these expenses in order to minimize the threat of pollution. And that's a very significant factor. And thank you very much, Judge, for pointing out the light.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley.
Thank you.
Ms. Carbon?
May it please the Court, good morning. James Carbon of the firm Duane Morris on behalf of the appellee cross-appellant Great American Insurance Company. I'd like to highlight 3 points for the Court this morning. First is with respect to Egan's appeal for an award of bad faith damages. Secondly, Great American's cross-appeal to strike the damages award by the district court. And thirdly, the cross-appeal on the issue that, as a matter of law, the tug limit could not be exposed under OPA 90. Turning first to the issue of the bad faith appeal by Egan, I am somewhat perplexed by the appellant's argument that Great American duped the district court into applying the wrong body of law. As you heard from counsel, the appellant briefed the very cases that he says the court overlooked and argued them. I find it difficult to accept that we somehow misled the court into overlooking the argument and the briefing by the appellant. I can also add that having spent considerable time before Judge Keneally, I don't think he's that easily duped. Furthermore, the district court, in its capacity as trier of fact, this was a bench trial, affirmatively held that Great American Insurance Company acted with good faith. Regardless of all the allegations and the mud slung against Great American by Egan Marine, the trier of fact found that Great American acted in good faith. That finding of fact clearly has not been shown as clearly erroneous at this level, and it stands. That finding of fact prevents a predicate element to any award of bad faith damages against Egan Marine, whether under New York State law, admiralty law, or any other body of law. Nor could anyone suggest that Great American did not act in good faith. The record is clear, and it's undisputed, that within 24 hours, Great American had a response team on site for the spill. That response team, Meredith Management, led by Captain Tom Newman, remained on site for over a six-month period until June, when the United States Coast Guard Federal On-Scene Coordinator, the officer responsible for overseeing the entire cleanup, signed off on the cleanup and declared it was over and done with to its satisfaction. Furthermore, it's undisputed that Great American expended in excess of $6.5 million in achieving the cleanup. In essence, Egan got the full benefit of this policy. They got an immediate response. It was a lengthy, substantial, effective response. Money was thrown at this until it was resolved. And at the end of the day, Egan got exactly what the policy afforded it. The United States Coast Guard federal officer in charge declared the cleanup over and done with.
Well, they were still exposed to liability after that June 7th date. Isn't that right?
I'm sorry, Ron, I didn't hear
that. They were exposed to liability after that June 7th letter?
I can't agree with that, Your Honor, and I know that's what the district court held, and we take issue with that, and that's part of our cross-appeal. I don't know where that supposed exposure comes from.
Well, they got sued.
I'm sorry?
They got sued, and your policy says you've got to supply a defense.
They did get sued, Your Honor, by the Illinois EPA, as Your Honor noted earlier. But when we look at the complaint, they got sued for two things. They get sued for an injunction against future spills, i.e., don't do it again. And they get sued for a penalty for having spilled in the first place. The Great American Policy clearly does not apply to either of those. You can't insure against an injunction not to do it again. And the Great American Policy, Clause B8, states we don't cover penalties except one very limited type of administrative penalty, which is defined by a statutory code section, and that is not, and it expressly excludes any state law penalty. So all of the allegations in the Illinois complaint were expressly outside the scope of the policy provided by Great American. And let me point out that the policy provided by Great American protects against liability in Section B1 under the Oil Pollution Act of 1990 and any analogous state law under Section B2, analogous to OPA 90, which is if you spill, you have to voluntarily come in and clean it up to the Coast Guard satisfaction or to the appropriate state authority satisfaction. And that's exactly what Great American did here for Egan Marine. In terms of any continuing exposure, Your Honor, we have an issue, as I said, with the finding by the district court that there was a continuing exposure. Clearly, the Illinois EPA complaint didn't do it, and there was no other directive. From the date the federal on-scene coordinator on June 7, 2005 said we're over and done with, there has been no other directive or order of any sort to Egan to clean up the barge or to clean up the site.
Well, there doesn't have to be in order for there to be coverage.
I heard counsel say that. I'm surprised. I don't agree with that. The policy covers 2702 liability under OPA 90. OPA 90 has a very well-defined scheme of how it operates. And the way it operates, according to the regulations promulgated by the U.S. Coast Guard charged with enforcing it, is they come in, they identify a responsible party. That responsible party has to clean it up until the Coast Guard Federal On-Scene Coordinator signs off on it. That's just what happened here.
Right, but or its state equivalent is also covered.
Correct. And
it
has been.
Illinois authorities were still investigating and at least communicating that there might be continued liability.
Following June 7, I don't agree with that, Your Honor.
There's a May 31st letter, isn't there?
Well,
that the oil in the barge represents a continued substantial source of contamination, cannot be left unaddressed, etc.
And that's part of our cross-appeal, Your Honor. The only thing the district court relied upon to find that there may be further exposure beyond June 7, when the federal on-scene coordinator signed off on this, was an unauthenticated, unknown email produced and admitted into evidence, which should not have been. We don't know where that email
You're going to lose that evidentiary battle.
I'm sorry?
You're going to lose that evidentiary fight. It's an email from the IEPA, and that's a public record.
It purports to be, Your Honor, but we don't know who the author is. We don't know what role he played. We also know
the district court accepted it as an exception to the hearsay rule, so we're going to affirm that. We're not going to overturn that. So you're kind of stuck with that as an evidentiary matter.
Are you speaking for the majority?
I am speaking for myself, okay. Counsel, but that's the standard of review you're facing. It's a very steep standard of review, and you are likely to lose that argument.
I understand, Your Honor, and I appreciate that. Let me make this one comment for the full panel. The email is unauthenticated. It purports to be from an individual at the IEPA. We don't know who that individual is or what role he played, and he himself in the email says, based upon my understanding, we don't know where he got that or what it is. And I think it was inappropriate for the court to rely upon that email and admit it into evidence. Thank you. Let me also speak to the arguments about what the applicable rule of law concerning bad faith is. And counsel has criticized Great American for advocating that admiralty law governs. In fact, both parties argued repeatedly before the district court and to this court on the first appeal that the case is governed by the admiralty law. In Egan's motion for summary judgment, document 37, they argued the bad faith claim was governed by admiralty law. Document 51, in the underlying case, they argued the same. Document 124, document 133, and to this court, in its reply brief on February 22, 2008, Docket 072655, they argued admiralty law governs its bad faith claim. Great American only argued New York law after the district court determined admiralty law didn't apply and New York law should apply. So that's how we wind up in a position of arguing admiralty law is the governing standard for the bad faith claim and not New York law. Irregardless, whether admiralty law or New York law, the predicate element of bad faith has been held in favor of Great American and against Egan Marine. So there can be no award of bad faith damages. If I can talk about the discussion about buy economy and Pan Asia. Your Honor is correct. New York's highest court is the Court of Appeals. The appellate division is an intermediate level of appeal, and it is part of the New York State Supreme Court, which is the trial level court. Buy economy and Pan Asia were decided by the Court of Appeals as companion cases. In bioeconomy, the Court of Appeals maintained its prior line of cases, exemplified by NYU versus Continental, which identified what conduct qualifies as bad faith. And in essence, they said there has to be, as New York courts have said all along, there has to be some egregious conduct causing injury to the policyholder, directed at the policyholder, and part of a public part of a pattern of conduct aimed at the public generally. It's a very high standard. That standard was not disturbed by bioeconomy or Pan Asia or its progeny. Your Honor is correct that what bioeconomy and Pan Asia did was recognize that in the right circumstances, if there is a finding of bad faith, then there can be award of consequential damages.
My understanding of those cases is that they represent a new rule of damages, not a new rule of liability.
I agree.
That a fair statement?
I agree, Your Honor, and I think the facts in bioeconomy make that very clear. Bioeconomy involved a commercial insurance policy that provided for business interruption loss, so that when the company suffered a loss and the insurer didn't pay the business interruption loss, the company went under. As a result of that, the court said, there was a finding of bad faith, number one, and number two, they said the natural loss resulting from that or flowing from that bad faith injury were the consequential loss of the loss of the business. And that's what bioeconomy and Pan Asia and these other cases stand for. They do not disturb, and bioeconomy cites NYU versus Continental itself, they do not disturb the standard required to prove what is bad faith conduct in the first instance. Couple that with the trial effects finding that Great American affirmatively acted in good faith, I think the bad faith claim is entirely without basis. Let me turn to the cross appeal. And there are two points I want to talk to on the cross appeal. The first one is the award of damages against Great American. And we have two issues that we've raised in that regard. First, the award of damages of some $378,000 representing the supposed work between the June 7 Federal Launching Coordinator letter and the August 31 EPA complaint was simply wrong. And it was wrong because what the court did was fashion a method to award some element of damages to Egan, but in fashioning that award, they used the exact same rates that it had already found Egan had failed to prove. In three separate instances in the opinion below, at page in the appendix 830, 832, and 836, the district court held that the rates Egan was claiming had not been proven. In fact, said Egan didn't even try to prove it. But yet those are the same rates that the district court seizes upon to develop a method to fashion some kind of award for this period, June 7 to August 31.
Ms. Carbon, Great America didn't offer, though, an alternative calculation, did you, to the district court?
what Great American did, Your Honor, yes and no. And this is in the testimony. Captain Newman testified to it, and Julia Price testified to it. When all of this was happening, Great American wanted to wrap this up. Year end was coming, and in October, November, they go to Captain Newman and say, listen, we've got to get this cleaned up. What's the best information we can get to get this done? Captain Newman goes out into the market, and he gets sample rates from other companies. He takes those rates, and he plugs them into the hours and work that was done, and comes up with three different numbers. The highest number, and this is in the opinion, is $588,000. Great American says, well, that's a high number. It's the highest of the three, but we're going to give them the benefit. And they pay that $588,000. So those are the alternative numbers that Great American was best able to come up with. But in truth, Your Honor, the district court recognized that it's Egan's burden to prove the numbers and substantiate its rates, and the district court held very clearly that Egan never did it. So Great American paid its limit, and then the district court turned around and said, well, I think I can create some kind of basis for billing between June 7 and August 31 using the very rates that the district court found were improper. That just doesn't work. And that award should be stricken based upon the district court's improper methodology and Egan's failure to substantiate the rates that it was based upon, or any other rates.
Well, Judge Cannelli did discount it by 20% in an effort to arrive at a cost basis on some rationale, because nobody was really providing one
right. Otherwise.
So, you know, what's wrong with that?
Well, as the trier of fact held, that 20% discount or standard rates did not prove that was their cost.
The district court, as I understand the court's rationale, is that it's a ballpark. And because the evidence didn't provide anything more specific, it was a reasonable ballpark. The judge concluded that they were entitled to recover for that interim period over the summer and had to come up with a measure.
I appreciate the district court was trying to come up with a ballpark, but at the same time, the district court itself said improving its rates, reasonableness is not the standard. Improving its rates, it's obligated to prove what its cost was. And the district court, as the trier of fact, clearly held Egan had not done that. Yet the district court turns around and uses those same rates to arrive at some kind of ballpark. We challenge that, Your Honor. We believe it was improper. The second point I wanted to address with respect to the damages is that any damages were owed beyond June 7 and August 31. And I think, Your Honor, we may have touched upon that already. The only suggestion of any continuing exposure is the email from the IEPA. The complaint certainly makes no other suggestion, and there's been no other directive or order by any government office. And I would suggest, Your Honor, that as much as the district court looked at the complaint to infer that by that time the IEPA was not going to take any further action directing a cleanup of either the site or the barge, the equally clear inference is that they never were going to. So that once the federal on-scene coordinator on June 7, which is a week after the IEPA email, by the way, once the federal on-scene coordinator signs off and says, we're done at the site, we're done with the barge, and the IEPA doesn't do anything further, we know there's no further exposure. And that is reaffirmed by the IEPA complaint and their lack of action in the many years since then.
Well, that is basically what the district court held, that by the time the filing of the complaint on August 31st, it was clear that the Illinois regulatory authorities didn't think there was any future contamination exposure, and so it cut off the exposure at that point in time. But there was that period over the summer, and that's what we're focusing on here, that it was at least a possibility, and a very real possibility, according to the trier of fact, that there would be exposure until the complaint was filed. What's unreasonable about that conclusion based on the facts?
Two factors, Your Honor. Number one, as I mentioned, I think the IEPA simply reaffirmed that there never was an intent to go further. And why didn't they? Because of the second factor, which is the subsequent to the IEPA May 31 email, the June 7 letter from the U.S. Coast Guard Federal On-Scene Coordinator saying, hey, we're done. We're done with the barge, and we're done with the site.
Right, so, as far as the feds are concerned.
And the IEPA was following, if you read the correspondence, the IEPA is really following what the Coast Guard does because they deal with these issues all the time. The IEPA didn't have experience in dealing with this magnitude of a catastrophe. The Coast Guard specializes in marine oil spill cleanups. In fact, the Coast Guard pointed out to the Illinois EPA, if you try to do more work here, you may be creating an even bigger problem because you're dredging up the bottom now, and that's going to release whatever other stuff is down there. And secondly, you're entraining the oil that may be down there into the bottom, which we don't want to do either. So there is really no indication of exposure beyond the June 7 letter from the Federal Launching Coordinator declaring everything done.
What remedy are you seeking? Not a retrial, certainly.
No. We're looking at the award of damages for that period, June 7 to August 31, be struck.
So you want that off the books, everything else is okay?
No. There are two other smaller damage awards that were granted, and we've appealed on them also. They were in the briefs. There's an award for a consultant to Eagan Marine to advise it how to avoid the Illinois EPA violations at its dock. Apparently what Eagan did, they delivered most of the cargo to the customer. Some of the residual, they had to take off the barge because the Coast Guard said you're no longer certified to carry cargo, you have to get it off the barge. They took it off the barge, put it on the land at their property, and mixed it with wood chips. And the Illinois EPA didn't like that. And Eagan was awarded $10,000 for a consulting fee to get that corrected. We don't see how that relates to an OPA 90 exposure. That is not an OPA 90 cleanup expense, nor is it an expense to avoid an OPA 90 exposure, particularly once the Federal Launching Coordinator signed off. The second item are the defense costs for the Illinois EPA action, and I touched on that earlier, Your Honor. The Illinois EPA complaint doesn't come close to being covered. It seeks an injunction against future spills, and it seeks a penalty that simply isn't covered anywhere in the policy. So that expense is not covered. While I'm on that point, let me talk about the allegation that Great American didn't issue a reservation and somehow they were in bad faith for that. There was no need to issue a reservation. Great American responded within 24 hours. They spent over $6.5 million. There was no issue about coverage until August, after the January spill, when Mr. O'Malley, for the first time, writes a letter to Great American and says, hey, what about the tug limit? That's the first time any question of the tug limit being involved was ever raised. Why? Because the U.S. Coast Guard designated the barge, and only the barge, as responsible entity. Therefore, there was no reason to even consider the tug limit might be involved.
Well, the barge is not a vessel without the tug, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The barge is not a vessel without the tug because it's not self-propelled. This is the issue on the Lisa E. policy limits, right?
You bring me to my third point, but I see I'm out of time. I'll be very brief. I submit an entire brief to you. A tug is a tug.
You're not out of time. You've got how many minutes do you have?
Four
minutes.
When the red light goes on.
Thank you for the rescue. a tug is a tug. The federal regulations make that clear. OPA 90 makes that clear. A tanker barge is a tanker barge. They're subject to entirely different regulatory restrictions, entirely different regulatory constraints. OPA 90 has different financial guarantee requirements for a tug versus a tanker barge. You cannot say a barge is a tug or that two vessels are one. The concept is anathema to the whole premise of OPA 90, which predicates liability upon the vessel which spills the oil.
Well, it also says OPA 90 holds liable not only vessels that discharge the oil, but also pose the substantial threat of a discharge.
Correct. And that's where the
barge do that, Mr. Garvin?
Sure. Once it ruptured, it was number one, it spilled oil, and as a ruptured hull, it presented a continuing threat, which is what Great American spent $6.5 million mitigating. Not only the cleanup, but they got the barge up and back to the yard and removed the threat that it posed, which is what the Federal Launching Coordinator said on June 7, May 18, excuse me. The barge no longer presents a substantial threat of discharge, and we declare that response element over. But the entire predicate and the congressional intent behind OPA 90 is that the vessel that spills is the responsible vessel.
But didn't the federal government claim that the Lisa E was a responsible party? And to that extent, you're obligated to defend, and your argument about whether it is or isn't goes to the merits.
Well, yes, Your Honor, and let me address that. First, what all the cases that the court has before it from both sides are cases where the responsible party, designated by the Coast Guard, had to respond for the cleanup. And then to the extent they chase a second vessel, a tug, for example, that punctures a bunker tank when it's shifting a ship, is really an indemnity by the responsible party seeking a claim over for the party that actually caused the incident. And that's what all those cases involve. In this instance, nobody has suggested that the tug lessee caused the spill. And in fact, Your Honor, we have two problems with the USA action. Number one, we have a motion to supplement the record with the decision in the USA action so that the court has it before you. And in that, you will see that the USA abandoned. We also supplement the record with the pretrial order. You'll see that the USA abandoned its claim that the tug was in any way responsible.
So maybe you don't have an ongoing obligation to defend, but certainly up until that point you did.
Well, it's also our position, and this was the other point I wanted to make, that the tug, as a matter of law, could not be liable. It did not spill.
That's a merits question, not a coverage question, and or a duty to defend question.
Let me be clear on that point, Your Honor. The policy covers exposure to Section 2702 under OPA 90. You cannot be exposed to a legal impossibility. The tug, it was legally impossible.
Well, then you argue that to the court as a merits defense against the federal government's action on behalf of your insured.
But we tried to intervene in the USA action and were rejected. And Egan said that issue should be resolved in this litigation in opposing our effort to intervene in USA action. And Egan had no interest in and they controlled the defense of the USA action. They had no interest in raising that issue because in proving that defense, they'd lose the defense funding that Great American was supplying. That's why we're here talking about the issue. But it is a coverage issue because the policy covers exposure to 2702 of OPA 90. It is a legal impossibility for a non-spilling vessel to be exposed to a 2702 OPA 90 discharge liability.
So the tug is exempt then from OPA 90, even though it's carrying, 14,000 barrels of oil?
I'm sorry, 14.
That would be the result, right? That it would be exempt from OPA 90?
The tug, as any other secondary vessel, secondary party, may have exposure if they caused the incident in the first place. Then the responsible party would have to respond.
Tug caused it, you're saying?
No, the tug did not cause it. In fact, Egan.
No, I'm saying, is that the only way it would be covered under OPA 90, Mr. Carver?
Well, they wouldn't even be covered. That would simply be a claim over on an indemnity or some other theory of a claim over. And we look at all the cases that Your Honor has before you. All these cases talk about a party spilling, a vessel spilling, being designated the responsible party, having paid the cleanup and performed the cleanup. Then, when the mess is resolved, they stand back and they seek indemnity or some other relief from the party that caused them to spill in the first place.
Thank you, Mr. Garvin.
Thank you.
Mr. O'Malley.
Thank you, Judge. As far as the OPA 90 that you just concluded, counsel has not cited a single case to support his argument that it's a legal impossibility. I cited 4 or 5 cases where a tug has been found liable under OPA 90. Not a single case from Great American. That's an issue of candor that we talked about before. Counsel suggested that I had taken an inconsistent position and therefore that had excused Great American's inconsistent position. The position I took in the pretrial order, which I have before me, says, this is Egan's position, both New York and Admiralty law recognize claims for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. That has been our position consistently. And when the court went ahead and misapplied Kerry Oil and applied the wrong legal standard, and we talked about, I've already quoted from Panagia from the appellate level case there, doesn't have to be a finding of bad faith. Therefore, the court applied the wrong legal standard. And the question is, when the court went ahead, after ruling against Egan as a matter of law, and made that determination that there was a finding of good faith. The issue is quite clear. What legal standard was applied? Certainly not Panagia. The next issue that we have talked about is, Judge, you had asked a question about a voluntary cleanup, and counsel replied with a recitation of OPA 90 and statutory authority. This is a case where the policyholder keeps going back to the insurance policy, and the insurance company doesn't want to talk about it. In fact, the language of the insuring agreement says expenses voluntarily incurred in order to avoid liability. The next issue that we had talked about was the IPA letter. Attached as part of Great American's appendix is a June 7, 2005 letter from the captain of the port to the Illinois Environmental Protection Agency, Jim Ross, stating, "It is my understanding from our previous conversations that IEPA will be seeking a complete site remediation from the vessel owner. As previously discussed, my decision to end the recovery phase of this response does not affect IEPA's rights to determine final site remediation standards and associated actions." That was very consistent with the a document that we've been talking about, the IEPA document. Counsel suggests that he doesn't know where that came from. It came from Great American's files. It has Great American's bait stamp on it. That's where that document came from the IEPA, from Great American's files. So the argument that it's not an authentic document is one that just baffled me, particularly when...
I think he's just challenging the authorship, not the authenticity.
That is a document that was in Great American's file that came from the IEPA to Egan Marine's lawyer, who was reporting to Great American.
Is there an issue on who sent it? That's all I'm asking.
Absolutely not. It came from Great
American. I understand it comes from the agency. I guess who in the agency?
And that document specifically refers to the sender, and then it was forwarded on to Egan and Great American and came out of their files.
So now is who in the agency sent it?
I'm sorry?
Who in the agency said it?
I looked for that document. That's the one document I don't have. There is a specific reference to the author. My best recollection, if I can offer it only as a recollection, is that it was Mr. Ross, who's referred to in the Captain of the Port order.
Mr. O'Malley, just to clear up, what's the status of this IPA, IEPA lawsuit? Is that over?
With respect to the action, the IEPA lawsuit, that action is over. Egan prevailed on it. With respect to the barge, it's still sitting in the canal.
No, I appreciate that.
Thank you very much for your time.
All right, thank you. Thank you to all counsel, both counsel, and the case is taken under advisement.